It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin woman who competes at the international level in arm wrestling. We'll find out what she loves about that sport. First, Xcel Energy is proposing a new transmission line on the tip of northern Wisconsin. According to the company, the project is needed to strengthen power in the area. However, affected landowners want more information before it goes forward. And in Superior, protests continue against Enbridge Energy's Line 3 replacement project. Five people were arrested during protests yesterday after blocking entrances at a pipeline contractor in Superior. Danielle Kading is a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica.
So where is this proposed transmission line set to go?
It's supposed to go on the tip of northern Wisconsin, basically in the Bayfield Peninsula. It'll run around 22 miles around the peninsula, about 3 or 4 miles west of Ashland, and it'll wrap around and go across the peninsula, past Bayfield, up into the Cornucopia and Herbster area.
Now, are there other existing lines in the area right now?
Yes, there is an existing transmission line in the area, and what Xcel is proposing is to build another line in a different route. Basically, it would be the same power transmission line. It would be a 34 kilovolt line, but they want to put it in a different place because of issues with maintaining the current line. It's hard to get to, it's not easy to access, and there are safety concerns for the workers when they go in there and do maintenance on the line.
So aside from the safety concerns and the access issues, what is the need, according to Xcel, for the new line?
Well, they say that, you know, this line is vintage, that it's circa the 1950s. And so whenever there's an outage, because of the difficulty in getting to the line, it could be anywhere from 4 to 8 hours before they get power restored for people. And it seems to be more of an issue in the Bayfield area and the Cornucopia and Herbster region, where they just have low voltage, and Xcel says they need a secondary source of power.
Now, Xcel has said they considered alternate routes. Why did they pick this one?
They picked this one because it just seemed to be the best option for the same amount of cost. Again, the access issue and reliability of power were some of the major considerations, as well as the safety of workers when they go out and maintain the line. The new route that they proposed would be easier to access, kind of run along existing roadways in the area. So it would be much easier to get in there and restore power if there were an outage.
So if the line goes through on the route as planned, who would this affect?
This would affect around 130 landowners as proposed. It would also affect 7.5 miles of county forest land. And so basically what Xcel is talking about is they would follow these existing roadways, but landowners would see poles sited within the first 5 feet of their property line.
And you talked to a homeowner during your reporting. This is new, but you got some initial reactions. What are people saying about how they might feel about this?
Well, people just have a lot of questions. They feel like they weren't adequately notified. Some of them are Bayfield Electric customers, or they just got mail from Xcel when they put out a mailing to notify people this is a project we're considering. They saw that it was from Xcel, and they just ended up throwing it in the trash because they didn't understand why it would impact them. And then when they had the open house, they felt like that was really their first introduction to the proposed route that Xcel is considering. And so they want to take more time to ask more questions about what it is that Xcel is proposing, what they have considered, and whether there are any other options that they may not have looked into yet.
And so does it look like so far residents might get that opportunity to weigh in on the process and maybe slow it down a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, Xcel has said that they are delaying their time frame for when they had planned to begin the permitting process. They were planning to start that with the Wisconsin Public Service Commission next month. They said that they're backing off from that because they want to take time to talk with more people about the project and why they feel it's needed.
And moving forward, what happens next? What are we looking for?
So kind of what's happening right now is there's a lot of talk within these communities about this proposed route, and a couple of towns have passed a resolution asking for more time for consideration of this project with the county, because Bayfield County had tabled issuing an easement or permit for the project on the 7.5 miles that would be affected on county forest land. They may take that up again on their next meeting, which would be on September 19th. So basically, the towns and surrounding communities are saying, please, Bayfield County, hold off on any decision as far as what you would do to offer a permit or easements to XL. We want to work with you before any decisions are made, because they're concerned that if the county green lights that, then basically the towns and the residents will be in a tough spot and things will start to move more quickly than they're comfortable with right now.
We're talking to Danielle Kading right now. She's a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio Superior Bureau, talking to us about a new proposed transmission line by the company XL that would be slated to go through the area in northern Wisconsin. And Danny, you mentioned that the line would go through some county forest land. Is that of particular concern to anyone so far?
It doesn't seem to be right now. A lot of the concern is coming from private landowners. It doesn't seem to be as big of an issue as far as forestry concerns for the county. So I think most of the resistance is coming from residents who just want to know more about the project.
Now, looking at another hot spot in northern Wisconsin, you covered recent rallies against the Enbridge 3 replacement line. What are the protesters? They also call themselves water protectors. What are they concerned about there?
Well, they're concerned about how replacing this line would send more oil from Canada to Enbridge's Superior Terminal. Right now, Enbridge Energy has proposed replacing this line, which a lot of the protesters take issue with that language because they're abandoning the old line, the 1960s era pipeline in place, and building a new line in this corridor that they've proposed. And so right now, the existing aging pipeline carries about 390,000 barrels of oil per day from Canada to the Superior Terminal. Once finished, if this project moves ahead, they could see up to 760,000 barrels of oil per day being moved through this new replacement line.
So have the protesters in northern Wisconsin still been active, or have things gone quiet? What's the state of it?
You know, I mean, since the middle of August, it seems like there were a handful of incidents. There were a couple incidents that ended in arrests. The first one, I think, there were 5 people arrested. And the second incident, there were 6 people arrested. And that was just last week. So I guess it remains to be seen whether or not we'll see more incidents. I mean, I definitely think that the protesters feel that they're going to keep pressure on this project, especially on the Wisconsin side, since Enbridge is already constructing a 12.5-mile segment of that Line 3 replacement project because they've received all the necessary permits from Wisconsin. In Minnesota, that's not the case. They're still going through the permitting project for that route. So I think there's a lot of concern from people who are opposed to this project. They don't want to see any construction happening right now, and they're going out there and making themselves heard.
And what about Enbridge itself? Has it had any public statements in Wisconsin lately responding to protesters?
Yeah, I mean, they've said all along, basically, since the first kind of incident started, that they are open to dialogue, respectful dialogue with people who have differences about this project. But they've said that they're just not going to tolerate people who are trespassing on the construction site, because they say that puts the protesters at risk, it puts their workers at risk, and it puts the environment at risk. One of the things that they're concerned about is that having people who aren't familiar with this area, that they may somehow disturb pipelines that are already running underneath this construction site. And so they definitely don't want to see any type of issue, like, God forbid, a spill result from any incident.
So, Danny, what happens next?
Well, I guess right now they're still working through the permitting process in Minnesota. They're continuing construction in Wisconsin. On the Minnesota side, regulators there aren't going to make a decision until it's expected to come sometime next April. So right now they're taking a lot of testimony from different groups. People who are in support of the pipeline and against the pipeline are filing testimony with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And on the Wisconsin side, if construction continues to move forward as Enbridge plans, then they plan to finish that 12.5-mile segment of the pipeline by mid-November.
Danny, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Danielle Kading is a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio's Superior Bureau. She joined us there to explain the latest details on a proposed transmission line in northern Wisconsin. First, a woman from Plover, Wisconsin, just got back from competing in the World Arm Wrestling Championship in Budapest, Hungary. She earned a coveted spot there by winning first place in her division at the American Arm Sport Association's National Championship earlier this year. Shauna Feist is with us right now, and she's joining us. Shauna, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Shauna, how did you get started in competitive arm wrestling?
Well, it was about 17 years ago when I first met my husband. He was actually into arm wrestling at the time. He was pretty good, so I kind of went around to tournaments with him, and I eventually started competing in these little tournaments, and it kind of went from there.
And I understand that you really like the adrenaline rush. You like roller coasters, and it sounds like arm wrestling is kind of in that same category. I wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, it is. Definitely, you get that thrill. You get the sick feeling before you go on stage, arm wrestle. You know, and some people like that and some people don't. But
so what part is the adrenaline, does that come up when you're kind of really locked in hand-to-hand with somebody, or is it more of the butterflies beforehand?
The adrenaline starts before the match. Probably a good, 5-10 minutes before the match, I start feeling it pretty good, and then it just gets, stronger and stronger. So when I'm up, to my match, I have, a lot of adrenaline going through me, and so I'm ready to go.
So checking on different brackets in the national and international competitions, it looks like you can arm wrestle right or left-handed, and you do both, is that right?
That's right.
How come?
Because I actually like the variety of people. They're not the same people. I'm arm wrestling left hand as I am right handed. Some people don't do both. And I like the competition. I'm not as good right handed as I am left handed, but I still like to compete right handed as well. I don't train as hard right handed either as I do left handed. But
are you left-handed?
No, that's the weird thing.
Oh, so you're right-handed, but you prefer wrestling with the left. How different is it?
I don't know. I just feel the most strength from my left hand. My form is better left-handed. My technique is, more put together left-handed. I'm still learning. I'm still relearning, I should say, everything all over again. Because I took like a few years off, and now I'm just coming back into the sport. I'm about 6 months into the sport now.
What made you decide to get back in?
There was a state tournament coming up, and I talked my husband into going to it. And we went, and it just took off from there. I won the state title in my weight division, and so that's where it all started.
So within a weight division, does that mean you could be wrestling men and women, or do you have to wrestle someone of your same gender?
You wrestle your same gender, and you wrestle within your weight class. So they have weight classes that are about, I think they're about 10-20 pound difference in between the weight classes. I could be a little wrong. I wrestle in the 154 and under weight class. So, and then there's 154 and above. I think there's one above that as well. But we had a couple of girls from the United States arm wrestling, and well, we had one in the lower division and one in the higher division, so we represented each weight class pretty well.
I have only arm wrestled for fun and mostly, you know, with friends. And I always thought, and you know, we haven't looked up official rules, that you couldn't really use your body for leverage, that it had to be all about what was going on in your arm. So why does it matter, if, you know, how much you weigh?
It's actually the opposite of that. You do use your body as leverage, and it's not just your arm. Yeah, you use your shoulder, you use your hip, you use a lot of, you know, a lot of your body for momentum, for strength.
We are talking with Shauna Feist right now. She earned an invitation to the World Arm Wrestling Championship in Budapest, Hungary in 2017 by winning first place in her division at the American Arm Sport Association's National Championship earlier this year. And Shauna, you're legally blind, and I've heard that you choose to compete against sighted opponents instead of a bracket for people who might be blind like yourself. Why is that? Why did you choose that?
Well, I feel the competition is equal, if not better, I would say. And I like to set my standards high, and I don't feel like I should let my vision get in the way of what I want to do.
And I've read that even more than that, that in a way you think it might give you an edge.
Yeah, it does, because I don't see, you know, my opponent, their facial expressions, I guess you could say. So, you know, that's a good thing for me.
Do you use, you know, that kind of nonverbal tactic yourself when you're arm wrestling? Do you try to give someone an intimidating face and knowing that you're not going to have to worry about seeing their response?
No, I'm pretty, I don't know, I'm pretty pretty in tune with, you know, being there and being, you know, up at the table, and I kind of like stare off into nowhere before I start arm wrestling. So no, I don't really look at my opponent much, and I don't really make faces, I guess.
And how do you prepare mentally? Because I'm sure a lot of this is physical, and we have to talk about how you train. But what about the mental game?
That's pretty difficult, especially coming back into it after being gone for so many years. I had, you know, am I good enough? Am I gonna get, you know, completely squashed here, you know, what? And plus you need mental strength just to go through the training that it takes to become somebody, you know, at this level. You need dedication, you need determination, you need, you know, day in and day out. You got to be pretty strong mentally.
How do you get there? How do you get to that place of mental strength? That can be tricky for a lot of people.
It can be, but I guess the more you do it, the more confident you get, the more comfortable you get. When I first walked up on the stage, I was so scared. My legs were shaking so bad. It was my first time ever competing in the world, and there was, you know, over 2,000 competitors there, so I was pretty nervous. But, it gets to be a little easier as you go on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the physical aspect of the training. How do you prepare yourself to get ready to arm wrestle?
I do a lot of workout at home, more than the gym. I do weights with, like, dumbbells, and do a lot of curls, a lot of hammer curls. I do a lot of finger strengthening and a lot of wrist strengthening. It's just to get my, you know, my wrist, because that's an important part in arm wrestling. So that's what I do pretty much.
Do you think that strength that you've built, and also the mental strength that we were talking about, do you see that benefiting you in other parts of your life?
Sure, definitely. Yeah. It's got me interested in being a part of, you know, other things in life that I normally, you know, wouldn't try, I guess. So, yeah, definitely.
I noticed in some photos that you're a mom, and I wonder if you're trying to teach, you know, your I think it's a son I saw, about arm wrestling and what it can bring to the family. Is it a family thing now to arm wrestle?
Well, it could be. Yeah, my youngest son's 9, so we're trying to teach him, you know, the form and kind of how to arm wrestle. And we'll see where it goes. Yeah.
So I imagine you sitting around the dinner table and afterwards everybody arm wrestles.
Yeah, you'd think that, but no. My husband and I practice a lot, but we never really go compete against each other, you know. So.
And is your husband still competing as well?
He is, yes.
And you're 39 now, or thereabouts anyway. How long do you want to keep on competing?
Oh, my, as long as I can. There's people that are, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old that are in the sport. So as long as my body will let me keep competing, I'm going to keep striving for, you know, that first place.
What encouragement would you offer to someone who wants to try something new, maybe something like arm wrestling that feels challenging, maybe beyond their abilities? What would you say to them?
It's not beyond their ability. Everybody can arm wrestle. Anybody can arm wrestle. It's something that everybody's probably done at least once in their life. They're familiar with it. Don't be afraid. There's how many matches that I had to lose to get where I'm at. You just keep going. You just keep going. And eventually you get better and better. And so.
Persistence.
Yes.
Well, Shauna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Shauna Feist. She is a Wisconsinite who earned an invitation to the World Arm Wrestling Championship in Budapest, Hungary, where she placed first in her division, actually eighth in her division in Budapest and first in her division at the American Arm Sport Association's National Championships earlier this year. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time. First, it's time for Food Friday. We don't get to say this often, but there's a new hot vegetable in town. You may have noticed that home cooks and professional chefs are jumping on the sweet potato bandwagon, and for good reason. They're good for you, relatively inexpensive, and they taste great. Well, all that combined has led our next guest to call sweet potatoes the perfect food. And in a new cookbook, she's sharing some ideas for creating delicious and unique dishes with sweet potatoes from classics, like sweet potato fries and chips, to more adventurous stuff like sweet potato cinnamon rolls and ice cream. Mary Frances Heck joins us now. She's a food writer, recipe developer, and chef. Also the former Test Kitchen director of Bon Appetit. Her new book is called Sweet Potatoes, Roasted, Loaded Fries, and Made into Pie. Mary Frances, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned there, you think sweet potatoes are the perfect food. Tell us why that is.
Well, I love sweet potatoes. I mean, who doesn't like them? You know, just to have a roasted sweet potato at dinner is a delicious thing. But on top of that, they're super nutritious. And it's one of those things you can either get kids to eat them, people who are not super adventurous about vegetables. You know, everybody kind of likes them. They're very appealing, but they're also really healthy.
Right, and they haven't necessarily. I mean, they've been around for a very long time, but it seems
sure.
like their popularity, on the other hand, is skyrocketing. Now you see things like sweet potato fries on menus alongside, you know, regular French fries. Why is it? Why do you think they're picking up in popularity?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. I think the reason they've become popular now is that they've been promoted as part of a couple of diets. So folks who might have concerns with blood sugar or, you know, high cholesterol and they need to eat a high-fiber diet, they can eat sweet potatoes sort of without worry. And they're sort of a delicious thing that you can dress up or just have simply. In addition, they've been included in diets like Whole30 and, you know, the paleo kind of ideas of eating. They're sort of an allowed starch within those diets. So I think people are just sort of interested in learning about dishes that you can make that aren't, like I said, just a plain roasted sweet potato as well.
And the crazy thing is, it seems like you can do almost anything with them. You can turn them into breads. You can put them into desserts. And then, of course, you know, you've got your sweet potato fries. You have a recipe for a sweet potato Big Mac, which looks really, really good, I have to say. Why? What is it about them that makes them so versatile?
Well, so they kind of toe the line between savory and sweet. So you've got sort of an earthy quality to them. Depending on how they're cooked, they could either be silky or starchy. They can hold their shape or fall apart. And so with those qualities in mind, they're very adaptable to the recipes that you just mentioned and many other ideas. I found particularly in baking that a mashed, you know, cooked mashed sweet potato can be added to any variety of doughs or batters to make really interesting breads and cakes that are, you know, beautiful, orange, sweet, but also they've got a little more nutrition. So they're a little bit better for you. Not so sinful, but just as indulgent.
Now, I get a little confused between sweet potatoes and yams. Usually this happens around Thanksgiving. What's the difference?
This is the million-dollar question. So here's the deal. Yams are an entirely different vegetable, let's call them. They're tuber. Sweet potatoes are technically more of a root vegetable than a tuber. And that difference is what the plant is prone to store. So when you have a sweet potato, it's going to be storing fiber, minerals, you know, vitamins, and a little bit of sugar, along with a lot of water. Tubers tend to hold simple starches. And so you see that with white potatoes as well as true yams. So a true yam is going to be a sort of a white to creamy yellow fleshed, starchy, you know, plant that grows under the, or food that grows under the ground. But it's got this thick, dark brown, bumpy skin. And the real key is that you're not really going to find them in most grocery stores in the United States. Most shops are not going to be carrying yams. So if you're going into a store and you see them labeled as yams, you're buying a sweet potato. Hmm. And where that confusion came from, the story goes that in, I think it's the 1930s, the Louisiana sweet potato growers wanted to differentiate their sweet potatoes from, let's say, Mississippi's. And so they started calling them yams. And it was just sort of a marketing idea, but it really stuck. And so that's where the confusion originated.
Oh, interesting. So there's quite a history here with sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about where they come from?
Yeah, so they're from Central America originally, and they have traveled the whole world. They are found in a variety of Asian cuisines. They're found in Polynesian islands as well and grown in Hawaii, for example, and Japan. They are also becoming very popular in the UK as a substitute for regular potatoes. And again, I think due to the health reasons, and they're also delicious.
We are talking with Mary Frances Heck right now. She's the author of Sweet Potatoes, Roasted, Loaded, Fried, and Made into Pie, a whole recipe book devoted to the sweet potato. And so let's dig into some recipes right now. You shared one with us for Irish fish pie. Walk us through that one.
This is one of my favorites. I grew up in New England, and which is not the home of the sweet potato, but it certainly is the home of wonderful seafood and all these different casseroles. And so I was thinking about it, and, you know, the sweetness of sweet potatoes and the sweetness that you get from really fresh fish complement each other so beautifully. So I thought, why not, you know, make a silky puree and swoop that over the top of an Irish fish pie instead of a, sort of a plain white mashed potato. And it's if I do say so, it's delicious. it's perfect for the cold weather coming.
What is different about the taste? I think we actually have one of our regular Food Friday guests made a fish pie with some potatoes that were white. And I'm curious about what you think changes.
Well, I just think the sweetness of the sweet potato almost brings out the sweetness of the fish, and it also acts as a foil against the brininess of the shellfish. And that's something I love, sweet seafood, you know, sweet shrimp, scallops, lobster, all of those things are going to have a heightened sweetness from the sweet potato. I think it works really well together.
I suppose then you also have the beautiful color, because if you're doing a straight up Irish fish pie with white potatoes, it's going to be a whole lot of, you know, white looking food.
It can look a little bland, yeah.
Right. So we have that recipe up on the Central Time, the Ideas Network Facebook page, I should say. And let's move on to sweet potato ravioli. This is another one that sounds delicious.
Oh, I love this recipe. It's from my friend Gerard Kraft, who has a restaurant in St. Louis and Nashville. And he came up with this super pungent sauce that's delicious. And again, it's one of those things that it foils with the sweetness of the sweet potato. So that sauce is going to be tomato-y, and it has some sardines in it. It's a little fishy. And when it's served with the sweet potato stuffed ravioli, it's incredible. You taste things, and you taste the brininess of the sauce and the acidity of the tomato in a different way, I think, than you would if you had like a cheese filling.
I love the idea of a homemade ravioli. I've never actually pulled that one off at home. How hard is it to make our own ravioli?
Making ravioli is not hard. Do not be intimidated. But I would say that if you are thinking about cutting out one step, instead of making your own dough, you can buy pasta sheets, fresh pasta sheets at gourmet grocery stores or at a local pasta shop. And that's a great way to kind of get a head start on the dish.
Gotcha. Well, that's encouraging to hear. Yeah, that doesn't seem like a bad compromise, using the pre-made pasta. And then you still got your homemade ravioli. And I want to ask you about something quintessential with sweet potatoes, something we're seeing everywhere, sweet potato fry. So how do we pull off the quintessential sweet potato fry?
Well, here's the funny thing. Sweet potato fries are never going to be crispy just like French fries. And that has to do with going back to sort of our discussion of the difference between a root vegetable and a tuber. What's in it to start with? In a white potato, you've got some simple starch that wants to get crisp when it's fried. Sweet potatoes have much more water and much less starch to gelatinize on the surface of the cut fry. And as a result, what I like to do is one of two things. Either cut your losses and roast sweet potatoes in a fry shape, and they won't be super crispy, but they'll be crispy enough, and they're delicious. And I call those sweet potato fries the easy way. You just chop them up, toss them with a little oil, get them in the oven. And then what I call sweet potato fries the hard way, which isn't too hard, don't be intimidated. We batter the sweet potatoes with a little bit of a cornstarch slurry. And what that does is creates that starchy coating that will get crisp when it's fried.
And what about any spices or herbs? Do you recommend anything if you want to get a little fancy?
Oh, yeah. I love all kinds of flavor profiles on sweet potato fries. You can definitely go with a classic kind of, I feel like a lot of people put like a little paprika or garlic powder on them just to give them a little bit of that, colorful seasoned salt kind of thing. But I also really love, try Herbe de Provence or try Old Bay. I love taking them. You could even do like a cinnamon sugar kind of thing. Cinnamon sugar with smoked paprika. Now there's something, sweet and savory at the same time.
It's Food Friday right now, and we're talking with chef and writer Mary Frances Heck about what she says is the perfect food, sweet potatoes. And we're sharing some cooking advice and also talking about some recipes now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook with sweet potatoes? And what recipes do you want to use them in? What do you prefer? Do you ever swap them out for the white potatoes? And what turns out well for you? And what questions do you have about cooking them? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's Food Friday. We're talking with Chef Mary Frances Heck, who is the author of the new cookbook called Sweet Potatoes, Roasted, Loaded, Fried, and Made into Pie. And she's sharing some really awesome sweet potato recipes, and you can find one of those over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a sweet potato fan? How do you incorporate them into your cooking? And do you have a favorite sweet potato dish to share? We're getting into that autumnal part of the year when sweet potatoes start to taste really good. So give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Mary, I want to ask you, before we go any further about this recipe that you shared with us, sweet potato trail mix cookies. Walk us through that one. What's in them?
Yeah, so this is one of the a cookie that's, you know, just like any other, but it's got grated sweet potato in it. And I was able to sneak out about half the butter in a typical chocolate chip cookie recipe and add in sweet potato. And what that does is it keeps the cookie kind of moist. They're going to be a little bit cakey but crispy around the edges. And I just love what it does. The flavor of sweet potato and chocolate, for me in particular, is one of my absolute favorites. And this cookie also has got pecans and dried cherries. So I think they're a fantastic addition to a holiday cookie plate, but they'd be just as welcome if you're out for a hike or in a lunchbox.
And you also suggest trying to make sandwiches with these cookies. Can you tell us more about that?
I love cookie sandwiches. Like I said, I grew up in New England, and we have something here called whoopie pies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I love them. I love these cookies sandwiched either with marshmallow fluff, like you'd find in a whoopie pie, or a buttercream frosting, which you also sometimes find.
Oh, gotcha. I was thinking salami or something. I thought you were really breaking some rules. That could be good, too, though. I don't want to judge. I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah.
Well, we have this recipe for sweet potato trail mix cookies up on the Central Time Facebook page and the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we go now to Charlotte in Brooksville. Charlotte, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. What did you want to share?
Oh, I just wanted to share that my husband made beef stew this, I should say, put it in the crock pot this morning. Beef stew with the sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. And how does it work?
Well. You know what? He cut up, well, he, what do you do? Because I don't cook. Fried the meat, and then he put that in the crock pot, and then he put some sweet potatoes and carrots on top, and it turned out awesome.
Oh.
I just tasted some, so it's really good.
Nice. Sounds like you have a delicious dinner about to happen there, Charlotte.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling in with that. And Mary Frances, what do you think about that subbing in sweet potatoes for a beef stew?
Oh, I think that sounds like a great idea. I love how sweet potatoes can cook up when they're braised. You can use orange sweet potatoes, or I also really love white sweet potatoes in braises. I find that they lend a light sweetness to the pot, but what they also do is really absorb some of the wonderful flavors coming out. So something like a beef stew where it's going to be very rich and delicious, that soaks into the sweet potatoes and just becomes part of them. But they maintain their shape as well. So it's kind of a nice, you know, it's a beautiful thing to see in the dish and really delicious.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Charlotte. And we're going to go next to Kurt joining us from Toma. Kurt, hi.
Hello. Hi. Mary Frances, just one question and one recipe. The recipe came out of a need for my wife's diabetes. So I would like to hear any recommendations you have about sweet potatoes in a diabetic diet. Now, the recipe, she loves two things above all else when I cook. That's risotto and sweet potatoes. So I came up with a orange sweet potato braise with asparagus tips, sweet peas, and I experiment with different sauces or flavorings. And I pour that over a risotto that has been prepared with either a beef stock or a French onion stock.
Mm.
Oh, and one thing, a spice that I like to use on the sweet potato fries or any other just plain sweet potato preparation is ras al hanout.
What was that? One more time, please.
Ras al hanout.
Okay, that's one that's new to me. Kurt, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Your risotto sounds delicious, by the way. And I've made risotto maybe once or twice, and it's a time commitment. You're, yeah, good husband there cooking risotto for your wife. Mary Frances, could you talk a little bit about sweet potatoes in a diabetic diet, and what do you think about Kurt's treatment there with his sweet potato risotto?
Sure, yeah. Well, I won't claim to be a nutritionist, but I will say that from my research, I found that sweet potatoes are hypoglycemic, and so they're digested sort of slowly. They don't cause an insulin spike, despite the fact that they taste kind of sweet. And I think that is one of the best things about them. If you're concerned about eating white starches, which could cause an insulin spike, sweet potatoes are a great substitute. They eat like a starch, but they are in fact a little bit gentler on your system. And as for the risotto, that sounds absolutely delicious. Another thing I like to do personally with risotto is to get the risotto about halfway cooked with the liquid, and then I stir in like some sweet potato puree, and the whole thing turns a sort of pretty orange. And I found that that's like a tasty way to do it as well. But everything you're adding to it sounds great. And I also think Ras Al Hanout, which is sort of a spice blend from the Levant, would be a fantastic addition to sweet potato fries.
Oh, great. And I learned something there. Thank you so much, Kurt. And thanks for calling in with that. And another call here we go to is Kelly in Madison. Kelly, hi.
Hi.
What is your recipe?
I like to do twice baked sweet potatoes. So what I do is I bake the potatoes first in the oven, and then I cut them in half. I scoop out the sweet potato stuff, and I like to mash it with black beans, and I put onions and corn and salsa in there, and then I add some cumin and coriander and cilantro, and then I top it with salsa, and then add cheese right on the top and pop them back in the oven. They're delicious.
That does sound delicious, yeah. And I think you have something maybe a little similar in your book, Mary Frances.
Yeah, but that version sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I love to finish them, you know, regardless of what you mix back into the sweet potatoes. I love to top them kind of like nachos. So I love doing a little pickled jalapenos, sour cream, you know, scallions, avocado, whatever you would want on tacos or nachos. I love adding that as well.
That sounds fantastic, Kelly. Thank you for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. And Mary Frances, you mentioned sweet potato puree earlier, and I imagine there are other things you can add sweet potato puree to, and I know you use it in baking, but it can take a while, right? Because you have to, you know, peel your sweet potatoes, cube them, cook them, steam them, and then puree them. Is there a way to have a shortcut to get to that puree for your other baking?
You can definitely cheat with the microwave. Some people don't like to use a microwave, and I think that's fine, but I personally have found that when I'm in a rush and I want to get a recipe started, if you grab sweet potatoes, set them on a plate, you can put, you know, maybe 3 or 4 in at a time, and I prick them with a fork and then microwave them on high for 4 to 5 minute increments, rotating them and turning them until they're soft. And it can take anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, depending on your microwave. Just keep an eye on them and let them cool a little bit. You know, you want to make sure that a fork would go all the way through a sweet potato, and that's when it's ready to become puree. Then cut them in half, scoop out the flesh, and mash it with a fork or a potato masher or even, you know, like in your KitchenAid mixer until you have a nice puree.
And can you freeze that at all? Will that freeze well?
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of the best things to do. You know, I'll what I call triage 5 pounds of sweet potatoes, turn them all into puree, and then fill Ziploc bags with about 1 cup of sweet potato puree, because that's about what, you know, most of the recipes take, 1 to 1.5 cups. And then seal the Ziploc bags and stack them flat in the freezer, like little planks. And they'll freeze hard, and it kind of keeps your freezer organized that way. And then you can just pull them out and let it thaw in the fridge, and you're ready to go.
Oh, what a great idea. Well, we can't let you go without asking about sweet potato ice cream, which looks incredible in your book. What do you do for sweet potato ice cream?
So this is a really fun recipe. It doesn't have the exact same mouthfeel as ice creams that you might have had before, and that's because it is thickened with the sweet potato. It's instead of eggs or a starch, which are two ways you can thicken an ice cream, I thicken this ice cream with sweet potatoes. And so you cook the sweet potatoes in the milk and cream until they're tender, and then puree it with some sweetener and a little bit of spice, and then freeze it. And what you end up with is an ice cream that is lightly sweet, lightly flavored with the sweet potato, but is completely egg-free. And so I think that's a great choice if someone avoids eggs or just wants to try a different way to make ice cream.
Now, all sounds delicious. Mary Frances, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mary Frances Heck. She's a food writer, recipe developer, and chef, also former test kitchen director of Bon Appetit. Her new book, it's called Sweet Potatoes, Roasted, Loaded, Fried, and Made into Pie. And you can find a recipe for her sweet potato trail mix cookies over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A little while ago, the Cassini-Saturn team tweeted that the spacecraft had entered Saturn's atmosphere and they had received its final transmission. It also shared a note in this tweet that said, "Cassini showed us the beauty of Saturn. It revealed the best in us. Now it's up to us to keep exploring." I love that phrase, final transmission. They mean it literally. It sounds a little more poetic, like final transmission, if you know what I mean. And the Saturn team wasn't the only one to pay homage to the spacecraft. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted that Cassini gave us Saturn, but also gave us Earth, as only deep space could reveal. Small, frail, lonely, steeped in darkness. That from Neil deGrasse Tyson. And deGrasse Tyson added a picture, which included the massive rings of Saturn and an itty-bitty speck in the distance, which was planet Earth. And it did kind of put things in perspective, for me at least, and it makes you think about all the storms and stress of being alive together on planet Earth. And in the end, here we are. We're just a little speck in an ocean of stars. Another tweet from deGrasse Tyson reads, "Farewell, Cassini. How far you've come. On this eve in fiery death, Saturn and you are one. VIP," he ends, "vaporize in peace. 2004 to 2017.